Hello and welcome to What Else Do You Do? I'm your host, Misao. I'm a producer at Studio Cut to Bits in Montreal. Today, our guest is Raphael Bokamazzo. Please introduce yourself.
Well, hi there. I am, well, Raphael Bokamazzo, but better known as Dr. B for long Italian name reasons. At one of the internships I used to be at, the guys took one look at my name and just kind of went, no. And Dr. B stuck. To even to the point that some of my friends call me Dr. B, even though I'm like, you don't have to. But I am a doctor of clinical psychology. I'm a non-practicing doctor of clinical psychology who is the clinical director of what was the first mental health nonprofit to serve the game community, takethis.org. And in addition to my activities doing a lot of outreach and education with Take This, I'm an expert on the applied use of role-playing games in clinical and learning settings. I love getting to teach clinicians about Dungeons and Dragons, especially if they've never played before. But gosh, what else do I do? I do a lot of weird things.
Can you tell me a little more about that, like applied use of Dungeons and Dragons?
Sure,
in a clinical environment? Like how does that work?
Well, so A lot of people assume we're taking a game and that a game has intrinsic therapeutic properties for, you know, psychotherapy and learning. And that's not entirely true. The pantheoretical model that I helped develop along with my co-author, Dr. Megan Connell, it holds that there are three core competencies to doing this. One of them is a mastery of the theory and application of psychological and or learning interventions, as well as a mastery of the game system or systems that you're using themselves, as well as a transgressive a willingness to engage in play for the sake of play. And the TLDR version of that is that we take behavioral interventions, psychological and behavioral interventions, or I did back in the days when I used to work with people directly. I don't anymore. But we would take established interventions and break the game to meet those interventions. It's not like any game itself has magical psychotherapy properties unless it's specifically designed to be psychotherapeutic. It's that we modify the game to meet the therapies. Mm-hmm. An example I can give is, so I was trained heavily in something called cognitive behavioral therapy. I was actually trained by one of the students of the guy who created cognitive therapy. And the one thing we would do is sometimes externalize people's automatic thoughts about their anxieties, their fears, whatever. And I would have people create separate character sheets, one for their rational thoughts and one for maybe their anxieties, their depression, whatever. And we would talk about ways to essentially level up their rational thoughts. Like somebody might tell me the attributes on their rational thoughts that it's like really high intelligence score. It knows what's up, but its charisma is awful and its strength score is terrible. Meanwhile, their irrational thoughts, their anxieties, their whatever, super charismatic, dumb as stumps though. And it was a question of like, how do we get the rational side to be able to meet and or beat the irrational stuff? And so that's just one possible application of figuring out how to break the game to meet the needs of a client.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense though. The fact that like you can use a role-playing environment to, you know, to kind of work through some of your issues seems very, you know, when you think about it, it does seem pretty straightforward.
Yeah, there were a bunch of us who have fought that over the years. And funnily enough, the like Adam Davis and Adam Johns at the nonprofit Game to Grow are very good friends of mine. And same thing with Megan Connell and Jack Birkenstock over at the Bodana Group. And there's just a bunch of us who independently came up with this idea of applying things like role-playing games. And eventually we met and were like, oh, I wasn't the only one to think about this. Because I personally had some tremendously therapeutic, which is not the same thing as therapy, by the way, experiences growing up playing Dungeons and Dragons and other role-playing games, because one of the things I'm public about is my autism. Mm-hmm. I'm very autistic. I learned social scripts well enough that a lot of people can't necessarily tell But that's just because that happens to be one of my talents is I'm good at mimicking and figuring out patterns. Mm-hmm. And role-playing games back in my teens and especially my early 20s offered a safe framework to essentially practice different social scripts. And maybe not coincidentally, all of the characters that I created in my teens and early 20s were this kind of fantasy wish fulfillment of what I wanted to be, because I was so awkward. I was bullied to hell and back, and because I was so out of step with my peers. And all of the characters that I built in those days were charismatic. They were socially aware. They were excellent public speakers. And it was, you know, in my early 20s to mid 20s when I had this epiphany that, oh my God, if I'm playing these characters in this safe environment, their behaviors have to come from somewhere. Oh, wait a minute, they're coming from me. Maybe I can do that. And just started to externalize some of those behaviors, those social scripts that I had that safe space to practice and fail mm-hmm. at them in a relatively consequence-free environment.
Oh, well, that makes a lot of sense. And I feel like that kind of like experience is also mirrored by a lot of people I've talked to who have a love of, you know, both tabletop and LARPing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a common experience, which is part of the reason I try when I speak to these things on a professional landscape. And I know that this is what else I do, but the truth is I'm so fortunate that I get to do for a living the things that I always loved growing up. Like I still have my first 70 issues of Nintendo Power. upstairs I have I'm just going to straight up brag about this. I still have a factory sealed in plastic copy of Pinball from 1985, the Nintendo one. I've had that sucker graded and it is in Lucite. but I'm That's lucky really enough cool. to do what I love for a living, to intersect mental health and gaming. And so when I speak about these things, especially applied role-playing games, I try and very clearly say there's a difference between therapy, which is a trained process that you consensually agree to with a licensed professional, mm-hmm. and therapeutic, which could be anything. Anything that's incidentally beneficial to you. Maybe music is therapeutic. Maybe mm-hmm. Maybe Dungeons and Dragons happens to be therapeutic. It certainly was in my case. Maybe cooking is therapeutic, which it definitely is in my case.
Well, I think this is a natural break. So let's get back to the topic of the podcast, which is what else do you do? So what else do you do?
Well, what else do I do? I love creating things, and especially when it comes to food. All things food and drink. I grew up in a household. I'm only second generation American. My paternal grandparents came from Italy back in the days when it was not good to be Italian in this country, mm-hmm. and they settled in Seattle. Like apparently a lot of Italians did. There we used to have a significant Italian population. There's a whole history behind that, and why we don't anymore. But my father cooks like a wizard. My mom, who's not Italian, but my mom cooks like a wizard. I grew up around cooking constantly. And it just instilled in me this absolute love of creating things in the kitchen. And it doesn't just extend to the kitchen. I make my own beer. I make my own mead. In the last 6 months, I started roasting my own coffee. I just love all things food and drink.
I love cooking as well, so I can definitely relate. What do you like to cook? Do you have like a certain type of things that you do, or are you very broad?
Broad. Although okay. I have a bias towards simple ingredients, prepared simply, done really well. Like last night the dessert I had, I don't often make desserts, but when I do, I just like to make them good. And so the dessert I did last night, because it's summer, we have fresh fruit. I sliced up a couple of fresh figs. I put a fresh red plum in a bowl, put a scoop of vanilla gelato on top mm-hmm. of it, drizzled a little balsamic vinegar on top of it, crushed a little black pepper, and put some fresh thyme. And
that sounds very nice.
It was. It's refreshing. And I put this on Twitter and I put this on Instagram and people are like, oh my God, that's so fancy. And I'm like, it's just simple ingredients. There was no cooking involved, really. There was no heat applied. Well, it was ice cream, so no. But it was just, you know, herbs, some spices, and fruit. And ice cream. Well, gelato. But yeah, simple. But apparently done really well, and it was delicious.
One of the things I really like to do, which I don't get to do that often, and especially now with COVID, is to cook for large groups of people. Do you enjoy that? Or smaller, more confined, like more
intimate, like, dinner parties?
Yeah, intimate, but yeah. Like more elaborate, smaller dishes? Or
I like the more intimate groups of people. Four to six people is just wonderful, because one, I mentioned my autism earlier, and part of that is the reason I never cooked professionally is I've got processing issues, and the idea of keeping track of that many dishes going on at once is an interesting challenge.
It is pretty intense.
It really is the amount of working memory that's involved in, like, being a line cook or, you know, anything in a professional kitchen, not to mention the heat and all the fast paced nature of it. It's just it's staggering to me. But with an intimate group, I get to have an idea of what do they like to eat. We can talk while I'm cooking. We can really get to know each other, and then I can give them something that they love. And that's what it is to me. I mean, food is an expression of love, and I get to do something I'd like to think relatively good at for someone with no formal training. And I get to give that to them. It is an expression of my caring. I just love that experience. And I don't get to have the same experience if it's too many people.
Yeah, it's a little bit different. I mean, I love having dinner parties as well, but like there's something really satisfying about like cooking a large turkey or doing some kind of a roast, or especially things that take a really long time. I think the part of the reason I really enjoyed it is because probably I don't get to do it that often, because, you know, how often do you have, like, you know, 15, 20 people over to like eat a large piece of anything?
Right.
But I do definitely appreciate the intimacy and I think I do love feeding people, and I think my motivations are also very similar to yours. It's, you know, it's the way that I express my affection, because I don't know, being Japanese, I think I don't necessarily my affection towards people doesn't really necessarily come out very explicitly, because culturally we are more
not
reserved.
As demonstrative.
Yeah, so I think that's one of the ways that I've kind of learned to express that.
Yeah, and I will say, being autistic, there's a little bit of that for myself as well. One of the things a lot of folks with autism struggle with is something called alexithymia, and I'm no exception to that. It's upwards, I think, of 50% of autistic folks struggle with varying degrees of what's called alexithymia. And alexithymia is being able to essentially identify internal states in ourselves. I don't always know what emotion I'm feeling. Emotions are just loud to me. It takes me a while to kind of sort out the noise of, especially if it's an intense emotion. And there's so many times in social interactions where, especially when people are expressing affection, where there is this expectation of, in the moment, not just behavioral, but emotional reciprocity. Mm-hmm. And that's something I really struggle with, literally to the point of disability. I mean, it's less obvious in friendships, where I can kind of haw my way through it and deflect a little bit. But when it comes to like intimate romantic relationships, I mean, it's completely apparent that I struggle with that in the moment emotional reciprocity. And so acts of service, food, me being able to do things for people are a way of me being able to express that care and that consideration and that love for other people without necessarily the intimidating, overwhelming concepts of in the moment emotions.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, let's kind of get back to the kind of are the format of the podcasts, I'm going to ask the first question, which is, what do you get out of cooking that you don't out of your professional activities?
I get a break. One of the things I talk about in a lot of, because self-care is a huge part of what I talk about professionally, and especially in the game industry, where I'm not alone in being able to do what I love for a living. Whenever we merge two aspects of our lives together, it tends to complicate things a little bit, because we don't get the same rewards out of our avocations when they become part of our vocations. And so for me, aside from the fact that I'd never survive in a commercial kitchen, I just couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. The idea of me keeping this hobby sacrosanct and completely separate from what I do for a living gives me that necessary separation. I don't like to talk about work-life balance, because work is a part of life, especially in a COVID world where now one out of five of us are working from home. I talk about work-home separation. And being in a kitchen for nobody but me and whoever I care enough to give that food to, that is completely separate from my work life. And also the fact that I'm dealing with incredibly sharp knives makes me pay attention exclusively to what I'm doing. And that gives me that break, that respite, that all of that work-home separation that I just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. So completely disconnect from your work and focus on something completely different.
There's a mindfulness quality to it as well, that again, because I'm using incredibly sharp kitchen implements, or I'm using a kitchen torch, or, you know, if I'm doing a flambé or something, and there's safety protocols that need to be taken into consideration. Those safety protocols mean I have to be fully present. Otherwise, mm-hmm. I will literally get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, there's a mindfulness component to it as well as concentrating, because it does take a lot of concentration for me, because, you know, working memory and processing speed issues, it takes a lot of concentration for me to prepare dishes. So I have to be completely fully present in that mindful way. But more so than that, there's also this bonding to it when there's someone else present. The guy who was in my previous life when I was married, he was my best man at my wedding. He is a professional chef. He's now a licensed butcher. And when he and I get together, we just do nothing but cook and blast the Beatles. Because, I mean, I've known him for 25 years. We used to act together. We went to high school together. And so for us, words don't even have to be exchanged. It's just the physical presence of having that other person there engaged in this activity that we both enjoy. It's the pause. It is a separation, and it is just being in that moment in a way that I'm not always when I've got five emails coming in and three messages from three different messaging programs.
Oh God, like the messaging programs, it's killing me. I don't know if you remember back in the day, around 2000 or so, it was getting to the point where there was like all these like messaging software. There was like, there was MSN Messenger, there was AOL Messenger, there was like ICQ, and like somebody made like aggregators.
Yes.
And I was like, that was amazing. Like, can we go back to that? Like, can we have like one thing that will like bring all the DMs into one place, so I'm not constantly getting poked in like eight different apps at the same time that all do the same thing?
Yeah, that would be nice. I mean, in and of itself, that is part of the challenge of a modern work environment for me, is that, again, memory issues, working memory issues and processing speed stuff, all of the organizational tools are so disparate that I have to spend, you know, 50% of my working memory just to remember what organizational tools and what processes are going into what.
Yeah.
And that in and of itself becomes a part-time job for me.
Yeah, it's true. It's funny because like in larger companies, you would think that there'd be more standardization, but I've noticed the larger groups of people will have like more variation in terms of tools that they want to use. So you end up using more.
Oh, I wouldn't know. I mean, I take this as such a small organization. We have two full-time people.
Well, I'm now in a very small indie studio where we have like five permanent employees. So like,
yeah, so it's a very different
things are way thing. More manageable. Professionally, just email and like Discord and sometimes Slack. So it's really not so bad.
But you've got three right there. You've got three right off the bat there. We're going down the rabbit hole of like, it's so easy when you do what you love to just start talking about work. And this is this is what cooking, this is what preparation, this is what is beer making as well, because you have to sterilize things so much.
Oh, yeah. Cleaning. Otherwise you ruin the batch, right? So,
well, I mean, you're dealing with a living organism. Yeah. And as soon as it propagates, if there's any pathogens within what you're making, yeah, it just gets real rank real quick.
Yeah. Okay, so let's flip that question over. So what do you think cooking brings to you in your professional activity? How do you think it changes your process or your output?
It's a reminder to me that we need things outside of work. Okay, even the two of us, we're going down the rabbit hole quickly talking about our various work stressors and work frustrations. And cooking remains that thing that reminds me there is life outside of that. Mm-hmm. I think of our identities like a D20. And anytime you merge sides, it gets less complicated and also simultaneously more complicated to roll because it just gets wonky. And so me keeping things outside of work keeps me more balanced. And that's what it brings. And that's a reminder I bring to people that please build a life outside of work. Please have friends that are not game industry friends. For me, it's friends I've had so long that if I ever asked them to call me Dr. B, they would laugh in my face. So it brings a reminder that there is life outside of work, that there is life outside of games, that games are wonderful. The game industry is wonderful. I mean, it's the dominant form of media worldwide at this point. But there's stuff outside of it too. Mm-hmm. That perspective, when I'm talking to people, it's really interesting for me to talk about my love of cooking to them and to hear how many of them say, oh yeah, you know, there were these hobbies I used to enjoy outside of work. I should really get back into doing those. Yeah. And it happens every time. And I would love for people to do that too, because in addition, because games are a creative profession, creativity is divergent thinking. You can't have divergent thinking if everything happens in a bubble. And this is part of the reason that, you know, you get different people with different expertise. Someone who understands line prep is going to have a different thought process to project management than somebody who comes from, let's say, managing a zoo. And that's not a hypothetical. Our operations director at Take This has managed zoos. She has done everything, and it shows in how she works. If you bring someone in, and this is part of the reason when companies are like, we don't know about diversification. I'm like, no, dude, you're going to have better product. Bring in new ideas. You're going to have creative. You're in a creative profession. Why would you not do that? European fantasy has been done to death. Bring in new ideas. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's what it brings in, just new approaches, new ideas. Maybe the way I approach a talk is similar to the way I think about building flavor profiles into a dish. You have different components and you want to organize them in a certain way that are complementary. You want a little acid, you want a little sweet. You want a little bit of savory. And for me, I like a little bit of spicy. Sweet and spicy, best flavor combination. And yeah, just thinking about it on those terms, I think, yeah, that benefits me, sure, in how I think about doing talks.
No, that, I mean, you're kind of preaching to the choir, because I have a whole podcast about how people should have hobbies outside of game development. So yeah, I'm with you 100%. I really do think that You know, I've been in this industry for 15 years, and I've definitely seen what it does to people when it is like 100% of what they do, you know, and it's not pretty, you know. People are not meant to just work.
Yeah, even if we take the mental health aspects out of it, that diversification of hobbies and aspects of your personality is, you know, protective for your mental health. I keep coming back to this idea of creativity, that if you want to be creative, you need to go out and have experiences that are outside of what you do already.
For sure.
And no, that doesn't mean you have to go all Hemingway and go run with the bulls in Barcelona, but but to essentially consume different ideas and have a full appreciation of those ideas. It's not, because cooking to me, it's not just the food, it's the history. Mm-hmm. If you look at the history of food within a culture, the evolution of that food tells a lot about the history of that culture. It's part of the reason I'm just voracious about some of the cooking documentaries that have come out on Netflix recently. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing to show. My paternal grandmother, she could not fathom the idea why Americans had backyards and only grew grass. That is wasted growing space. You know, for her, coming to the Pacific Northwest, coming to Seattle, I mean, all the dandelions, just like, that's free salad. And it is. And it shocked me to go to the grocery store about a year ago and see dandelion greens for $4 a pound. I'm like, are you high? I just go outside.
Yeah. And dandelion just grows too. Like, it's a difficult plant to cultivate.
I mean, I get that we're paying for labor of collecting but I mean, being in Seattle, I'm just like, really?
It just grows everywhere. Yeah.
I'm just going to go outside. But, you know, she used to, my grandmother used to say, we eat everything but the squeal. And she's not even kidding. The idea of, you look at the way most Americans consume food, it's wasteful. Mm-hmm. There's so many things that you don't consume. Whereas, you know, coming from my grandparents, you consume everything.
Yeah.
Because that's expensive.
Yeah. And it's the same in Asia as well. You know, growing up in Japan, like their butchery is much more, like, you eat organs and it's not weird, you know. It's a delicacy and people enjoy it. And
yep.
It was kind of a culture shock when I came to the United States. And people were like, the fact that somebody would even say, like, oh, I don't like certain cuts of meat because it's tough. I'm like, what?
So cook it longer.
I'm like, what do you mean? Like, you don't, or I don't like pieces of meat that have bone in it. I'm like, this is just kind of baffling to me. You know, like,
I mean, I get not liking certain textures. I'm autistic. I really get not liking certain textures. Especially certain things that are tough, that are difficult to prepare. Like, I don't necessarily trust everybody who prepares tripe.
I don't cook tripe at home. Like, but
oh, God,
I will eat it.
So bad.
I will eat it. I mean, I'll go to a Chinese noodle place and have tripe in my noodles.
When it's done right, it can be wonderful.
Korean barbecue places and have all kinds of various insides that are grilled. But, yeah, I don't necessarily do that myself, but yeah. I mean, coming from where that was just normal, you know, like, things are supposed to have weird textures, and the Japanese are kind of like, there's a lot of slimy food in Japan, which is very difficult for people who, but, you know, like, squid, like raw squid can be pretty slimy.
Yes, it can.
Certain types of glutinous potatoes are also kind of slimy, like satoimo, yamaimo are kind of slimy. I mean, I can understand that, but I don't know. I guess to a certain extent, I guess that's the difference in culture, right?
Preferences. Yeah. And everybody has their preferences for certain things. Like, I mean, I'm going to like certain things that maybe you don't like, and vice versa.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, again, I have yet to acquire a taste for natto.
And a lot of Japanese people don't like Noto as well. It is especially on the hundreds. On the Kansai region. Yeah, the Kansai region. Although funny enough, modern Noto is less smelly than older Noto.
I remember it was more smelly.
Yeah, when I was a kid, like Noto had a stronger smell.
Oh my god!
They've developed Noto to be less smelly.
Oh wow! Yeah, I'm not. Then again,
but you know, you just kind of get used to it. It's like right. People and cheese. You know, like
I was just about to bring that up.
Like French people eat cheese that like straight up smell like gym socks, and you know, you just it's an acquired taste, and you just have to be exposed to it.
Yeah,
and it's much easier if you're exposed to it as a child.
Oh god, yeah. Oh lord, yes. And it's so strange for me to go to now high-end restaurants and order something quote adventurous that I'm like, that's pig's feet.
This is poor people food. What are you talking about?
Well, and that's an interesting thing in and of itself to look at especially the evolution of French cuisine becoming the standard worldwide, which I can understand why it became that, but I also think there's so much to draw from other things. That one of my absolute favorite cookbooks is a Japanese cookbook called The Enlightened Kitchen, and it's written by a former Buddhist nun who gives amazing tips for how to make vegetarian food that falls very much in line with my love of simple food done really well. There are some lotus root croquettes in there that are just amazing. Amazing. I did not appreciate the power of good kombu stock until I read that book.
Yeah, kombu does wonders.
Oh my really god, does. Yes.
Well, I think it's time to wrap this up. So I'm going to ask my last question. What is something you want people to know about cooking?
Practice, 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 and you will fail a lot. Start with recipes if you need to, but play around once you understand the why of things. In fact, let's do that. Learn the why of cooking as well as the how. Alton Brown is amazing at teaching the why things go together a certain way. Because once you understand, kind of like anything else, once you understand why things work together, you can start to have fun and play with it in the same way a musician learns scales backwards and forwards and then starts to play around with things and get to like pentatonic scales and so forth. You learning the why of cooking and why certain things do go together, why certain things don't go together, and how they all go together. You might think that learning that like that the temperature at which an egg yolk hardens is 160 degrees Fahrenheit. You might think that's random. It's actually really useful. So learn the whys of things. Learn some of the science behind it. Then you can have fun.
Oh, that's interesting. It is interesting to try to like kind of, you know, explore flavors and textures to be able to do things. And I've been kind of dabbling with that as well because I have more and more friends who are choosing to go vegetarian, and when they come over, I have to figure out what I'm going to cook for them because that has not been my traditional way that I've cooked. But it's
pick up that cookbook, The Enlightened Kitchen. It's okay, brilliant.
I think I will. Well, I think we've got it. So thank you very much. This was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you for having me. This was fun. This is a good way to start my Friday morning.
Well, have a good day.
All right, bye.
Thank you for listening, and thank you to Dave Wallace for providing the music, and thank you to Therese Lance for providing the logo. Bye.